Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Every once in a while, something occurs that captures everyone's attention. Most recently, it is America's Southern accent. It has been the subject of renewed focus because of the TV show White Lotus, or more specifically, Parker Posey's portrayal of a rich Southern woman from Durham, North Carolina. Her vowel sounds are rich with diphthongs, but the one phrase that has gone viral is
Piper, no!
That no draws out a one-syllable, two-letter word so that it sounds to many Americans as though it is multisyllabic and about 3 to 5 letters long.
Piper, no!
And because everyone is talking about her accent and trying to imitate it and figure out where it came from, we thought we'd explore that accent, the accent that distinguishes this part of the country from the rest and the fact that it is shifting, changing, maybe fading away. In fact, regional accents of all types are disappearing, but as people move and media influences the way words sound, homogenizing the way we speak. But these accents, even dialects, say something about culture, about identity, and give people a sense of belonging. So today, a closer look.
Piper, no!
I'm sorry, Parker, but yes, Walt Wolfram is a professor of English at North Carolina State University and the director of the North Carolina Language and Life Project. Tom Hanchett is a community historian and author of Sorting Out the New South City, Race, Class, and Urban Development in Charlotte. And Corey Mitchell is a Tony Award-winning educator and founder and artistic director of the Theater Gap Initiative. Welcome to you all. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you.
I should mention that Walter Wolfram is also the author of Talkin' Tar Heel, How Our Voices Tell the Story of North Carolina. There is no question, Walt, that Parker Posey's accent in White Lotus caught the attention of people all over the country. We've all heard Southern accents before, so I'm wondering why. Why was she so successful in garnering so much attention?
Well, in part because what she does with Southern dialect is a little overdone. So actually, while lots of people know, the way she says no and lengthens the glide is really kind of distinct and draws attention to itself, which is one of the things she's trying to do. I mean, what she's trying to do is portray herself as a character who is older, distinctly Southern and unique. And of course, people say, well, half of the time she's high and so forth. We haven't studied enough speech that's high to know the influence high on that yet. Although we have studied alcoholic speech, so we know what the effects of that are. But well, but actually, this is part of how she presents her character, which is also interesting because what it says is that this is not just about speech. This is about presenting your persona and the fact that you are presenting a Southern aristocrat, which is more typical of an older Charlottean. You know, when you go to Charlotte, of course, people say, who are the real Charlottetians? You know, where are they and so forth? But this sort of accent was more characteristic of older Charlotte people, and as well as Raleigh and Durham.
She's done a Southern accent in previous projects, not just the one we're talking about, but her husband in that series, White Lotus, Jason Isaac, is British. And there was a lot of talk about whether or not his pronunciation was accurate or even authentic. Was it?
I don't consider his particularly authentic. We've had sort of discussions over TikTok about the authenticity of his speech, and particularly about the fact that he says there are two vowels of Durham's speech that are distinct, and we've disputed that. I mean, we've done, over the last 3 decades, we have interviewed people literally from Manteo to Murphy, and figuratively as well, covering the whole state, over 3,500 interviews. We have plenty from Charlotte. No linguist has ever talked, I mean, plenty from Durham as well. No linguist has ever talked about the two distinct vowels of Durham. So I don't know if he got that from his dialect coach or actually where he got it. He's never produced them. He's talked about the vowels they are, but he's never actually produced them. So it's actually difficult to tell what he is talking about.
We're going to hear clips of some of those interviews that you referred to a moment ago, a little bit later on in the program. But you've also, as I understand it, been using clips of White Lotus in your classes. So I want to play a string of clips of Parker Posey from that series and then listen to what you have to say about them. That would be cut
We
four.
flew over the North Pole.
Timothy went to Duke. Saxon graduated Duke.
Because you need your family. You do.
I listen
well,
to a lot of clips.
One of the things that Parker Posey does is she had in the South the vowels of places like Duke and go and so forth. The vowels are more fronted. So that's why you hear so go or pole and so forth. What she does, and actually just about everybody who's Southern born and bred uses those. What's different though is people just say Duke rather than the Northern Duke. You can hear the difference between those. But what she does is she elongates the glide. So we can measure these sorts of things. So if you measured her vowel in terms of the core of it, the nucleus, and then the glide, you would find the glide much longer, which is what people capture in terms of, oh, that sounds distinct. So in that sense, what she's doing is she's overdoing the vowel for the effect that she wants to create.
Let me bring the
Another
acting. Let me
vowel
bring
in
the
there is
acting guy.
family, which can sometimes be family, right, with the little glide. And that's authentically Southern. That one she seems to handle a little more. Now, she is from the South originally, although she's from a different part of the South. She's from Louisiana and Mississippi, whose vowels are a bit different from those in the in North Carolina. She actually is very good at what she does, and her vowels are authentic, albeit overdone.
So let me bring in the acting guy here, Corey Mitchell. When you're playing a character, I don't care whether they're Southern or they're British or they're from Minnesota, it would be easy to overdo it and slip into caricature. So how often do these Southern accents that we hear portrayed, do you think, how often are they actually authentic or are they just teasing us?
They are teasing us in many ways because, to me, if you're Southern born and you're Southern bred, however it comes out of your mouth is going to sound authentic. But I've gone to a lot of shows in New York where it feels like they have to make it bigger to get people to get the point. And it drives me just a little bit crazy. And when I'm directing and when I'm working with students, I'm like, look, baby, be authentic, be real with what you're saying. And what is real is what is just coming out of your mouth. Now, to me, what is becoming different is part of our regionality with our Southern speech is like hearing how other people talk around us and emulating that. And I think that where we're really the difference is coming in is that now there are a lot more voices that we hear because of social media and things like that that really influence the way that that Southern accent is coming out.
But you know, Tom, as you walk around Charlotte, you don't hear a lot of that. At least I don't anymore. You just don't hear a lot of that elongating of vowel sounds like that. You just don't. How long has that been going on?
Well, my folks are from the Midwest, and so when we moved to the South when I was a little kid, which is about 60 years ago now, people's accents were so strong that often I could not figure out what they were saying. And that was people at many different socioeconomic levels. And wow. And today it's rare to run into somebody who sounds distinctly Southern.
So, Walt, I'm just curious about accents. Every region has its own accent. I don't know how many English accents or accents using the English language there are, but I just watched the last episode last night of Adolescence, and although I got the point, I should have turned the subtitles on because I couldn't understand a word they were saying. So I'm just wondering how and why accents develop. Why don't we just all speak English the same way?
Well, that would be sort of like everybody looking the same way, acting the same way, and dressing the same way, which is not all that interesting. But the fact of the matter is because of migration, you know, so for example, the western part of North Carolina is quite different because it's Appalachian English, but the people came down the Great Road, the Great Wagon Trail in the western part of the state. The people on the Outer Banks took boats to get to the islands and so forth. Other people migrated from Tidewater, Virginia. So first it starts with migration, and then as people settle in, they develop the community, and then they shift their language to sort of identify with the community. That's why when people say, well, how many dialects are there in North Carolina? I say, well, anywhere from 2 to 200. And people laugh and say, well, aren't you a linguist? I say, yeah, but it's really difficult because it depends on you where you are. So if you live in the western part of the state, you may say that every holler has its own dialect. If you live in the on the coastal area, you may say every island has its own dialect. But to outsiders, it sounds, for example, there's one Outer Banks when there are actually like three or four to people who live there. So it depends on people's perceptions, and also not simply perceptions, but it's more about people per se. So it's not about dialect. It's the fact that dialects represent identities of people who live in particular places. And people want to be from somewhere. You know,
when people
not all that popular.
When people from outside the South hear a Southern accent and identify it as such, what are they hearing?
Well, they hear lots of things because they associate it not so much with the South, but what their identity association of Southern people is. So when they hear a Southern accent, people in the North think of racism. You know, so if you talk Southern, then you are a racist, which of course is not true, but that's their perception from the outside. Or they also associate it with intelligence, so that you're not as intelligent because you speak like a whole country bumpkin and so forth. So there are all these sorts of associations that make accent not simply about sounds and words, but about people's identities.
It isn't just that the South has a lot of different variations, because the Texas twang is very different from what you would hear on the Outer Banks, and even what you would hear in West Virginia is different from what you would hear in North Carolina, in Charlotte, or any place else, Columbia, for instance, which we're going to hear a big difference in a second from Columbia. But you say that our state, North Carolina, is linguistically the most diverse of all the Southern states. How so and why? And I have 1 minute left, less than 1 minute.
Okay, so the reason is because the state is very diverse in terms of where it got its population. It's the most topographically divergent state in terms of the ocean, in terms of the mountains, in terms of ethnic groups like Cherokee and Lumbee Indians and so forth. So all of these factors have come together, and there are at least five or six distinct dialects that are both ethnic and regional. And also North Carolina was set up to be a state with lots of separate communities.
We have to take a break. We're going to come back and talk more about accent and identity when we do. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about accents, the Southern accent in particular, how North Carolina is the most diverse linguistically of all the states. Walt Wolfram is with us. He's a professor of English and director of the North Carolina Language and Life Project at North Carolina State University. Corey Mitchell is a Tony Award-winning educator, founder and artistic director of the Theater Gap Initiative. And Tom Hanchett is a community historian, longtime historian in Charlotte, author of Sorting Out the New South City, Race, Class, and Urban Development in Charlotte. And Tom, the Southern accent, as Professor Wolfram mentioned a minute ago, gives people an immediate identification about where someone is from. I guess the other side of that coin is the same in that when you speak with a Southern accent, it gives you a sense of who you are. Talk about identity and the importance of that and accents to that.
Well, there are some wonderful Charlotte stories of people using their Southern accent kind of as a tool, as a thing to get what you want. I think of a fellow named Hugh McCall, who, if you get him talking about how he built Bank of America, he will pretty quickly tell you that sounding like he was a country bumpkin from the South did not hurt when he was negotiating with high-flying folks from around the United States. And often they ended up doing a little bit more for him than they might have expected to.
Well, now he's told that story to me on the air that when he went in to get Bank America from San Francisco, they thought that he was just this little Southern boy and they're going to take advantage of him, and wham. Yeah. No, au contraire. So that can work in your favor. Well, that's another question I had for later in the program. I'll ask it now. Why do people assume that if you have a drawl, you're dumb?
Well, part of it is economic reality. For a long time, the South, even before the Civil War, was the most rural part of the United States. A lot of people not making very much money. In slavery times, that's absolutely true. But in the decades after the Civil War, this was the part of the country that people left in order to find opportunity. And educational systems were weaker here. There was less public investment in health and all sorts of things. And so when those folks started showing up in Cleveland or Pittsburgh or Chicago or wherever, folks with some justification assumed that perhaps they did not have the advantages that folks who were born in Chicago.
Corey.
There is also a part of that of how long it takes sometimes to get those thoughts out. And when the rate of speech, of slowing it down and getting that. And so often, particularly when you're in urban settings, it is quick, 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 quick. So if it takes a moment to get it all out, then they think that it takes a while for you to process what it is that you're saying. And that can lead to that feeling of ignorance, if you will.
Yeah, they do tend to speak faster in the Northeast than we do here in the South. In Boston, they park a car. In New York or New Jersey, someone may say, "You just want to go out for coffee?" Here, you might hear, "How y'all doing?" or "How's your mom or name?" Depending upon what part of South Carolina you come from. It isn't just vowel sounds. It's words, it's dialect, it's cadence, it's inflection. Walt, do we fully understand how all of that developed and comes together?
It's actually very complex. One of the interesting things, however, is that after the Civil War, Southern speech became more concentrated and more different. So while the seeds of differences were there before the war, following the war, they were really magnified as it became sort of a separate entity. And so there's an aspect of its historical development that went into the development of these features. So some of the features we talk about as commonly Southern, y'all, for example, are commonly Southern. But actually, there wasn't that much y'all before the Civil War. It really developed after the Civil War and became a sort of an icon of what Southerners speak. So the minute you say y'all, people sort of, oh, you're Southern, eh?
Tom, I saw you nod vigorously at that. And Walt says that before the Civil War, Southeasterners did not seem to have spoken in what we would recognize today as a Southern accent. And most of that developed in, I guess, the period between the end of the war, the Civil War, and the beginning of World War I. Is that because we were clinging on to the lost cause and we wanted to make it sound somehow special?
I haven't thought about that. I think that's a good supposition. I keep coming back as you guys talk to the multiplicity of Southern accents. When I was growing up, my parents from the Midwest, but we moved to the mountains of Virginia, and I'm pretty sure that folks did not say y'all; they would say you with a real tightness to it. I think media, particularly audio media, kind of smoothed out that Southern accent and gave us all of y'all all.
Yeah, you say, Walt, that before the Civil War, linguists say that Southerners, I'm not sure how they know this because there are no recordings of it, but they say that Southerners experience what's called the coil-curl merger. I don't want to get too tactical, but what is the coil-curl merger?
I'm not sure exactly, other than the fact that oral becomes, you know, is pronounced differently. The thing about the reason we know that Southern speech is because of spelling. So we can look at spelling and sometimes use that as an indication of what some of the phonetic differences were, because people didn't have a standardized spelling system. And so they would spell how the sounds sounded to them. And so that's what we use. Now, of course, that's imperfect, but it also is indicative because we have plenty of indication that spelling often reveals pronunciation.
That oi sound is particularly prominent in one part of the state, it seems to me. On the Outer Banks, there is the famous hoitoi pronunciation.
Yeah, that was brought to the area historically. Yeah. So that was brought, and you'll also notice that other islands, for example, Tangier Island in Virginia, and also Smith Island, they use that hoitoi vowel.
So what's hoitoi? Here's an example that Professor Wolfram provided us.
Hoitoi, what is it? It's hoitoi. It's high tide. It's when the tide comes up high, you know, on the sign side. Sign, like Pamlico sign.
Hoitoi on the sign side. Right. what is the origin of that? Is it from Britain? Is it from something else? What is that?
Actually, we think probably it was brought to that area from the southwestern part of England, which are also Arful dialects. They have their R's in that, and that's a dialect that's Arful. So we think that was brought there and developed because of isolation. It didn't change nearly as much and actually developed even more so in an isolated situation.
I saw a choreo production of Almost Maine, which takes place in Maine, obviously. And if you don't have the Maine, and it's more than just the accent, it's an attitude, it's the way people speak. It doesn't come across as being fully fleshed out, that play. You have to have that attitude and that accent. And I would think the same is true of a Southern accent. So when you're directing a play, you're working with young actors who are trying to do this, there are all these different accents, all these different styles. How do you help them? How do you choose which one to use, unless it's specified directly in the script?
Well, in some cases, it is written in the way that the playwright may write it dialectally with that. But quite often we will get a dramaturge to come in and sort of try to isolate that just a bit. I think about one of my favorite plays, which is actually in the Ozarks, which is Desire Under the Elms, Eugene O'Neill. And the way that he wrote that, I used to give that to students sometimes to mess around with. And their first response is, this isn't even English. How am I supposed to read this? And I'm like, well, baby, just say it the way it looks on the page. And that then start to develop that in that way as well. So it's hard to find recordings, if you will, and just agree across the board on what that sounds like. Or the other thing that I will do is say, go and talk to the oldest person that in your family and see what you can do to emulate what they sound like.
You know, if you were tasked with playing a Southern governor, you might put on this drawl. And maybe you'd be right, and maybe you'd be wrong. And we have two examples here of Southern governors who speak very differently. South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster has a particularly strong drawl. Let's hear him talk.
In 2022, we announced 120 projects which will create over 14,000 new jobs with $10.27 billion in new capital investment. That's almost 2.5 times as much as 2021 and more than ever before.
I searched high and low yesterday for a better clip than that that is more illustrative of his drawl. That's pretty mild when you think back on all the things he said over time. But he also calls residents of his state South Carolinians. Not Carolinians, Carolinians. Meanwhile, former North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper sounds completely different.
North Carolina is where the weak grow strong and the strong grow great. It never ceases to amaze me that this line of poetry written about our state 100 years ago could just as easily have been written yesterday to evoke the soul of North Carolina.
Now, Henry McMaster grew up in Columbia, South Carolina, and Cooper grew up in Nash County, North Carolina. I did the math. They're just 252 miles away, or only about 3.5 hours by interstate highway, Tom. So do either of them sound like people from Charlotte?
Both of them do, because we have so many sounds here. I'm aching to get into Peaches and Parker Myers.
Do you remember? That was my next question.
This was when I moved to Charlotte in 1981. This was the hot thing. Everybody talked about it. It was on one of the commercial radio stations, but it was an ongoing radio play. And the point of it was really accents, and Peaches and Parker Myers sounded like Mr. McMaster. Dropping the R, he was talking about OVA, so many years, such things happened, sounded like that elite sound that the Murphy in the Morning was playing with. And so, you know, within an area, you might have those different influences, you might have different appeals. I think Governor McMaster is appealing to the common folk of South Carolina. Mr. Cooper is dovetailing much more with the kind of folks that, you know, you might find in the big cities, Raleigh, Durham, that kind of area.
I want to give credit where credit is due. You're right about Peaches and Parker Myers. They're Murphy in the Morning on Big Ways back in the day. And Larry Sprinkle, who's still on television, was part of these skits in the late 70s, early 80s. And they were spoofing Myers Park and the old Myers Park accent. Does that still exist, Tom?
Much more few and far between.
And all of the people there would be quite old now, because there's been a total shift. In the earlier southern urban areas, not using the R was aristocratic. Now it's considered to be rural, so people don't do it anymore. But if you listen to some of these aristocratic people who are old in their 80s and 90s, they'll still be R-less and have lots of the features. But the younger folks are not like that at all, which is why, in a sense, White Lotus, the kids don't use the Southern dialect, because that's what happens. And that is authentic in terms of where they are generationally.
Yeah.
And I ran into that in the 1980s. I was an early volunteer at WFAE, and the lead announcer was someone who had grown up in the South and had, and I talked with him about this at one point. He very consciously taught himself not to sound Southern.
Right.
And that was the route forward if he was going to be the radio announcer he imagined.
Well, I had earlier in my career, I had young people come up to me and ask how they could lose their Southern accent because they wanted to be on radio or they wanted to be on television. And I said, why would you want to? Unless you're moving to New York or to Minneapolis or California, you're talking to Southerners in the South. Why wouldn't you talk like them? But they wanted to lose it because that was the thing. You had to be homogenous. And we'll talk about the influence of media and all this a little bit later. But if there is a patrician, or there has been a patrician Northern accent, which is readily identifiable, would you say, Walt, that Henry McMaster's accent is an example of a patrician Southerner?
Well, it is. But, you know, to him, it's just sort of natural. That's the way people talk in his community. And so actually, I think the identification of his speech as sort of being much more community oriented, as opposed to sort of the areas of Charlotte, Raleigh, Durham, and so forth, are characteristically not Southern now. But of course, they were subject to great masses of migration of Northerners in there. I live in an area where there are 50 some houses. The only native is the guy who sold us the property, and he's as Southern as can be, and the rest of us are all Northern. And this is the story of Raleigh and Charlotte and Durham and so forth. So in a sense, and I'm sure Tom can speak to this, this is sort of the historical migration that has taken place and changed the demographics of these cities.
And I do want to talk about migration and the influence of media and how young people are, as you mentioned a second ago, are in fact changing things. A lot of young people are rejecting the way their parents spoke. And I'm not sure why, but maybe that's always been the case. And maybe that's why we are beginning to lose these Southern accents. There are many, many things that are playing on that, I suppose, because language does change over time, and young people
don't want to sound like their parents. They want to sound like their peers, and if their peers are talking that way, that's the way they want to speak. Parents think they have more control over their kids' dialects than they do.
We're going to take a break. We're going to come back and hear a couple of examples of other Southern dialects that Professor Wolfram has collected over time in Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Our New South. This Charlotte-based Levine Museum podcast explores today's South through social, political, and cultural topics in their historical context, featuring conversations with locals driving change. Our New South is available on all podcast platforms.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Walt Wolfram, professor of English, director of the North Carolina Language and Life Project at NC State University, and author of Talkin' Tar Heel, How Our Voices Tell the Story of North Carolina. Tom Hanchett is a community historian in Charlotte and author of Sorting Out the New South City, Race, Class, and Urban Development in Charlotte. And Corey Mitchell is a Tony Award-winning educator and founder and artistic director of the Theater Gap Initiative. We heard a clip of former North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper, who grew up in rural North Carolina. We also have a clip from your collection of interviews, Professor, from a woman from Pittsburgh. And she's from a rural area, but she does not sound like Roy Cooper.
We picked blackberries in the summer, which was a lot of woods then. We have had 100 cans of blackberries. And Daddy went to the peach orchard back then, and he'd buy 20 bushels of peaches or more.
So talk about her accent from Pittsburgh.
Well, Pittsburgh is an interesting place because it's a suburb of Raleigh now, and it was formerly a farming county, and now it's transitioning because lots of people want an acre or two and want a goat or one cow or something like that. And so what is happening there, they tend to be a generation behind Raleigh because it's people from these areas that are moving out there. 50 years ago, they were primarily a self-contained community. And these, so one of the reasons we're studying, for example, Pittsburgh in that county is because it's changing in ways that Raleigh has previously changed. So we have over 350 interviews collected by one of my colleagues. By the way, you also have a study being conducted by Becky Roeder at the University of North Carolina, who is studying Charlotte speech, different generations, where she studies older people, middle-aged people, and younger people to see how that changes are progressing in Charlotte, because the cities are very drastically different. I say, for example, in North Carolina, that the cities, the urban-rural divide is stronger than the difference between Southern and Northern speech at this point. That's how drastic these changes are.
Wow. Well, let's hear a clip from somebody you describe as an aristocrat from Charlotte. I don't know how old she is, but let's take a listen and hear what she sounds like in comparison to, of course, Henry McMaster.
And these Northerners come down here and we take them in. And before you know it, it ain't the same. It's really not. They don't think and act like we do.
There's more in that clip than just the accent, but nonetheless, yeah. how long ago?
First of all, let me tell you that she grew up where where Discovery Place is now, in Charlotte. That's where she grew up. She was 90-something when we interviewed her in about 2005 or 2010, and so she is gone now. But she represents the older aristocratic person. She's artless. She has an unglinding of time as time and so forth. So she's got all of the characteristic features of Southern speech that people don't think of in terms of Charlotte today. You know, and she was an old timer, and that's why I say the older speech of the aristocrats is more like the rural areas. So in a sense, she's more like the person you just heard from Pittsburgh than she is sort of the governor from Nash County who changed his speech. So these are sort of interesting changes. And what she also is talking about, it's not simply about speech, it's about what it represents. So Northerners talk too fast, they're rude, you know, they say things directly and so forth. They don't say bless your heart when they're even insulting you. And so there are all these sort of interactional representations in her speech that are conveyed by her language.
Well, that brings up the topic of migration, Tom, and you've done whole studies on how Charlotte has changed because of migration and the things that the banking industry brought after the textile industry was collapsing, et cetera, et cetera. We're growing so quickly in the city with 700 some people, I think, moving here. Was it every day, every week, every month, something like that? Is that the primary factor in our losing our Southern accent in Charlotte?
I don't think it's the primary one. It certainly is huge. And a figure that sticks in my head, Mecklenburg County, 1990, had 500,000 people. Mecklenburg County, 2010, had 1 million people. And it used to be that folks moved to Charlotte. Charlotte's always been a city of newcomers going way back. Hugh McCall was a newcomer. Edward Dilworth Latta, the developer of Dilworth, was a newcomer. But it used to be the newcomers came from the Carolinas, Virginia, Georgia, those areas. Now newcomers are coming from around the United States and around the world. And that is something that I'm listening for. I'm not hearing it yet.
Well, why are we adapting our speech to reflect the newcomers and not the other way around? Why aren't they trying to fit in by changing their vowel sounds and softening their R's?
I think some of that's happening. When we moved to Troutville, Virginia, my brother, who's 2 years younger than I am, more quickly adopted, without being conscious of it, a Southern pronunciation thing. We later moved back up north, and people would make fun of him for the way he talked, not for me. So I think when you put one new person or one new household in this stew around us, they adapt a little quicker. But Wolfram, what do you think?
Well, I think it depends on people, you know, how they want to define themselves. It also depends on sort of the, like when young kids come, the density of the schools that they are in. Also, one of the things we haven't talked about is sort of like African-American dialects in North Carolina, which can also be very distinct. We have coastal dialects where we can play you people where blacks and whites have lived in Hyde County for three centuries. The old blacks sound like whites, and people from outside identify them as whites. The young kids sound urban, and they're sort of picking up because the urban areas are sort of the cultural norms for African-American teenagers today. And so they sound very black. So we have four generations of a family where the great-grandfather is identified as white. His great-granddaughter, who lives in the same house and always has, is identified as black. So there are changes in the African-American community as it shifts its norms towards sort of the cultural prestige of urban areas vis-a-vis rural areas. So there are also different dialects. For example, African-American dialects, small dialect areas in the Appalachia, they pick up more Appalachian English. That doesn't mean that they'll necessarily be defined as white Appalachians, but they certainly have more Appalachian dialect in their speech.
So let me bring the African American on the panel into this conversation here. Corey, obviously, if accent is a part of a person's identity, is there pressure among African Americans to maintain a certain style of speech?
You know, there are certainly all kinds of discussions around, do you sound black enough, or are you, like, how it is that we carry our culture and what some of those things are. And I think that in many cases, it isn't always about the accent, but it's sometimes about the words that are used and whether or not we are using things dialectally and, you know, some of the colloquialisms. You know, there are folks that are young that intentionally try to use some of those words and phrases. And sometimes it also depends on who they're being raised by. So I listen to some students in class and I'm like, baby, I can hear it. You were raised by your grandmother, and as opposed to being raised by your mom. And so there are, or mom and dad, you know, your parents. And so there are those influences that come in as well.
Are there pressures? I mentioned the young people who wanted to get into broadcasting. This is 25 years ago, saying they wanted to lose their Southern accents, otherwise they wouldn't be accepted. Clearly, there is some desire to, power plays an influence in all of this. And if you want to get ahead at a certain company, you want to emulate the power figures, and that includes the way they speak. So is there pressure on young African-American people trying to become actors or trying to become move up in the world, and they're taking your class because they're
professionals, period.
Yeah, becoming professional. And maybe one of the reasons they're taking your class is because they want to be able to know how to act in front of people, in front of an audience. Is there pressure for them to change the way they speak as a result?
Yes. Yes, there is. And I will say that as a part of Theater Gap Initiative, one of the things that we actually teach is a voice and diction class and talking about that. Because when students are applying to college and doing their interviews or auditioning, those first impressions carry a lot of weight. And being perceived as such and having to make a third and fourth and fifth impression for someone to understand you quite often doesn't happen for them. It is that first take, you know, you hear it all the time. I know if some, if I'm going to cast somebody in the first 20 seconds of their audition, I know if I'm going to accept someone into a program in that, because we immediately go to that. So yes, there is a lot of pressure that comes along with that. And it's put upon by the students. They seem to take it on themselves a whole lot more than I try to place it on them, if you will.
So some of this comes, I think, from the media. Beginning in 1922, when radio began to broadcast and when radio networks began to spring up, and most of the programming was coming from places like New York, maybe Chicago, some from Los Angeles. And the same thing happened when television came on the scene. And the same thing happened when movies began to talk. It began to influence the way we sound. And I'm curious about this, Professor. If you watch an old 1930s movie, if you listen to an old radio broadcast from the 30s or 40s, if you listen to President Eisenhower speaking in the 1950s, we don't talk like that anymore. Is that how the general public talked? Or was that because these were actors and public figures who took elocution lessons so they could be heard and understood prior to microphones?
I would say that, that actually this is the way they talked. So, for example, Roosevelt in the 40s was R-less, and that was standardized New York speech, right? After the World War II, everybody in New York wanted to get away from the R-lessness. And so things changed. So something can be socially prestigious in one generation and then the next generation be socially stigmatized, like the absence of R in urban and rural areas. So we think of the South rural areas as being R-less now and the urban areas being R-ful. So things can shift rather dramatically and ways that sort of defy what we might expect in terms of our social norms.
And they're shifting now among young people. The University of Georgia did a study, and you've alluded to this, that young people don't like the way their parents speak in the South, so they have rejected a lot of the Southernisms that we hear. We talked before we came on the air about this change in ending every sentence and going up, because that's what this girl on the television commercials selling bath products always goes up at the end of a phrase. That's kind of a California thing. And there's something else called vocal fry that came of age in the recent past. Here's an example of that.
Switch to a different mic. They look identical, I think, for the last 10 seasons. But she gave me my original mic that I started with.
And so vocal fry is where at the end of a phrase, they close their throat. It's very bad for your voice. But why is that particularly prevalent, Corey, among young women?
My goodness. I used to call it, 10, 15 years ago, I called it the Kardashian effect. And Paris Hilton and Nicole Richie effect, because so many, I want to sound young and rich and above it all. And so nothing bothers me. And I will say that I don't find it quite as much. I think that since the Kardashians have become a bit of like yesterday's news, if you will, it is fading. Thank goodness. Thank gosh.
Well, there's something that's taking its place, and that is the lack of a liaison after a T before a vowel sound in Manhattan. It's no longer Manhattan among young people. It's Manhattan.
Ha-an.
So American English seems to be invading even Great Britain. I've watched a couple of these British television shows, and I sometimes think, is that an American actor? And I'll look them up, and no, they are a British actor, and they're playing a British character living in Britain, and they sound just like us. Is this a good thing or a bad thing, Walter, this dissolution of accents? And I have less than a minute.
Well, it's actually just a thing. It's neither good nor bad. Mm-hmm. It's sort of how people choose to interpret it. Yeah. I choose to interpret it as sort of the natural course and ebb and flow of language. that we become more homogenous, and then we become less homogenous again as we gain our identities.
But just in different ways, which is why
Just in different ways.
That's why Manhattan is becoming popular now, I guess. Wolf Wolfram is a professor of English and director of the North Carolina Language and Life Project at NC State University, and author of Talkin' Tar Heel, How Our Voices Tell the Story of North Carolina. Tom Hanchett, community historian and author of Sorting Out the New South City, Race, Class, and Urban Development in Charlotte. And Corey Mitchell, a Tony Award-winning educator, founder and artistic director of the Theater Gap Initiative. Thank y'all for the hour.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.